The Guardian.
Hello all, James Richardson here, and before we get started with today's edition of Football Weekly, I'm going to point you in the direction of our sponsor Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show. Football Weekly, 2 months to go, listeners, and it's all a-happening. FA Cup quarterfinals. Watford's Rocket Man sees them to Wembley as Arsenal talking of a sacrifice. 1-7 out of FA Cup. They can always bounce back, though, in their next game away at Barcelona. With Everton and Palace through two, we ran up all the cup action midweek and last weekend and talk Premier League as well. Top story here, Rafa in at St James's. Full terms of his deal with Mike Ashley, 0 hours, plus checking his pockets for branded sportswear at the end of each and every working day. Can he pull off a shot Monday night, though, away at top of the table Leicester? And why am I asking? Since you already know, don't you, listener? All of that, plus your posts and more in this Football Weekly. And with that, they were off with a very special Football Weekly. I mean, they're always special, but this one extra special as I survey the smiling faces of Nick Ames. Hi, Nick.
Hello, James.
Hi, Greg Bukowski.
Hi, James.
And Jonathan Wilson.
Morning, James.
It was a confusing weekend. I was left befuddled by the whole contemporaneousness of the Premier League, FA Cup. Who was playing in which? What was going on? I'm looking forward to hearing exactly what, you know, what it all meant. Let's start with what appeared to be FA Cup quarterfinals. What was the biggest story here? Jonathan, you saw every single one of these games.
I watched all four games, yep. Yeah. I would say, well, in terms of the biggest story, it's probably the Diego Costa bite. But in terms of the longest... The Diego Costa Neely bite.
Mm.
But in terms of sort of wider narrative, probably Arsenal going out.
Or Watford going in, as it were. Watford to Wembley. Wow. Mike Laxton says that Gajura goal for Watford has to be a textbook thunder bastard. Yes. I think we don't have Ian McIntosh here, copyright owner of that term, but I'm sure he'd give that a thumbs up. John Andrews, meanwhile, saying we could be heading for a Leicester Watford Community Shield. Yeah, that'd be quite a thought, wouldn't it?
Mm.
Yeah,
could rival that playoff game three or four seasons ago. Leicester and Watford, do you remember? All hell broke loose at the end of it.
With the penalty by Knockhart and then
the trading.
You go, I think Nick Miller of this parish wrote a very good piece about that last week, actually.
All right. Well, we're a ways away from that actually happening because Leicester would have to win the title and Watford progress through in a couple more games in the FA Cup. What did he make of their win anyway against Arsenal?
I think the really worrying thing for Arsenal is I don't think Watford were particularly brilliant. I mean, they played well. They took the two goals really well. But it was just another really sort of flat Arsenal performance. And they didn't really get going until 75, 80 minutes.
Hmm.
And, they could easily have equalised in that spell.
Yeah, how did they not equalise at the end?
But, don't leave it to the last 10 minutes. Right. And the defending on the first goal was just, I mean, really pathetic. There's no other word for it. Yeah, Gabriel, to start with, he's too tight. And having been too tight, he just lets him go. So, I mean, it was like the kind of goal, if you conceded playing, the rubbish level of football I played at, you'd be annoyed that it's just just awful defending, just weak.
The second goal was also quite interesting because you had, I think Ertzor took it, I can't remember who, off maybe one of the centre-backs, and he was quite deep inside his own half, ran up and got robbed, I think, and then the move started from which Guardiola scored his thunder bastard. And I think generally for Arsenal recently, and in that game too, Ertzor and Sanchez, who are undoubtedly their two best players, they're doing a lot of work. I don't think anyone can say they aren't, but they're not doing it in dangerous areas. Ertzor have the back heel for Welbeck's goal, yes, but Sanchez, for example, a lot of the work is coming wide and deep, and there's a lot of industry, but when are you seeing him really getting in an influential position in front of goal? And it's almost like they're having to operate in quite inconvenient areas to drive the team on, and no one else is really taking that initiative.
Mane has a theory that the two of them don't play particularly well together, and he wrote a piece, I mean, we're probably talking before Christmas now, before Sanchez got the injury, where he had stats which proved this. So I don't remember the exact details, but if Barney says it's probably true.
All right. Was a lot of that due to the fact that they were forced into doing their business in undangerous positions? Was that due to the fact that Watford had basically flooded the midfield and not left them any room in dangerous positions?
They gave them no space whatsoever. I mean, from the first minute, I thought they crowded space superbly. And to be fair, maybe first half especially, Elneny was trying to get on the ball, and maybe maybe in patches playing the best he has for Arsenal, although he missed a couple, didn't he, as well?
Mm.
But I think generally there's no one taking it by the scruff.
Well, it didn't help that they had Elneny and Coughlin. They were both two defensive midfielders, and perhaps that explains why they lacked a bit of thrust in the middle.
Gabriel should have walked, really.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a textbook red card foul. I mean, an astonishing, given where the referee was. I think those can be quite difficult if a referee's sort of behind the player making the tackle, but maybe you don't quite see the angle of a foot. But he's looking at that. I mean,
there's 2 feet, though, coming, like, actually coming in at the same time.
That's what I'm saying, the angle the floor, he's at, yeah, he should be able to see. It's not that his view's blocked by the player's body.
Well, I did ask somebody who's kind of connected with the Arsenal setup, you know, almost facetiously, oh, do you think Arsene's lost the dressing room? And they responded, he never really had it. He never talks to the players. And there does seem to be a just complete lack of it, of any sense of it mattering particularly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the other worrying thing, it's always easy to read too much into these things when things are going badly. But that the recklessness, the lack of discipline of that tackle, Ertzl's yellow card in the second half is something stupid and petulant. You can sort of sense the frustration. It's as if they've lost the sense of a common goal.
Right. 1 win in 7 now, 3 home defeats in a row. They've got that trip to Barcelona. We could talk about that now. We could talk about that later. We could also, if you feel that it's academic by this point, not talk about it at all. Arsenal's chances of pulling out one of those surprises that they spring every now and then in the Champions League when you write them off and they come back with a big win against a major team?
I mean, yeah, the smart odds are on them playing really well, winning 1-0, having a chance in the last minute and missing it and going out valiantly. And then it's framed as a big catalyst for the rest of their season and it falls flat, which I think happened a couple of times against Bayern and also Monaco last year when the tie was already beyond them when it shouldn't have been. So, I mean, I can't see them turning it round, but they might put a bit of an effort in, I think.
Greg, any chance for the Gunners?
Like, I can't see Barcelona not scoring, so no.
No chance for them?
None.
On we move. Sorry about that, Arsenal fans. Huh. Hey, they're not the only ones. Chelsea are also without a trophy to play for at this point in a season for the first time in what, you know, historians will surely look back and call the Abramovich era. This following their FA Cup exit to Everton. Another game that you watched, Jonathan?
Another game that I watched, yeah.
All right.
If you don't go out and you sit in front of the telly, there's loads of football on. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've basically been getting it wrong by getting trains to matches all these years. You miss loads.
You certainly do. Although with today's technology, you can enjoy several games on the train.
Yeah, have you tried Virgin Trains Wi-Fi? I mean,
yeah, actually, that's a silly thing to say. So, but luckily you were sat there, ensconced in your sofa or armchair, and were able to see Lukaku's tremendous goal against his former club.
Yeah, and it was a brilliant goal. I mean, everything Lukaku has, you know. He's got this great blend of strength and skill, and you saw both in that sort of 2 or 3 seconds leading up to the goal. There's the strength to check off the first 2 challenges, and then the skill to go past the next one, and then to open up Cahill and pick his spot.
Greg, you were saying, weren't you, on Thursday, if only they had Lukaku.
Well, yeah, and he's scored those goals he's wanted to score against Chelsea ever since he left there.
Since he left. 105 goals and assists, 77 goals, 28 assists, and he's 22 years of age.
He is so hard to handle. I thought Rob Smith described it really nicely in his minute by minute when he said the goal was part Shearer, part Messi, in that, you know, he had this all the brawn that Jonathan talked about at the beginning, but allied with this you know, lovely feather-toed finish at the end of it. And that's what he's got, which a lot of other bigger strikers don't have. At the end of it, you could often be off balance. He's often very, you know, very much still got all the balance and his equilibrium is right when he finishes.
Wow. I think the thing about his age is a key point as well, because you still see some people complain, oh, he's not that consistent. He's 22. I mean, you know, he thinks of something like
22. What were you doing at 22, Jonathan? Had you passed through your Tibetan monastery phase or not?
Yeah, I was well beyond that. I was 22, so I would have been 98. So I'd left Oxford and gone to Durham to do my Masters.
Right, okay.
Which was a good year to do it because I got to see every home game of Sunderland's 105-point season to be promoted out of the Championship.
Brilliant.
Heady days.
Wow, absolutely. Anyway, Everton-Chelsea. Greg, were you about to say something? No?
Quite possibly.
Nick,
I was just going to carry on with the Lukaku thing and saying, it is fascinating that he's just 22 and seems to occasionally cop a bit of abuse, well, not abuse, but a bit of stick when he has a lean spell.
Mm.
I think it was Arsene Wenger 4 or 5 years ago that said a striker, you can only judge when he gets to 23, maybe between 23 and 27. I think he was talking about Nicholas Bentner at the time. But,
right.
But I think the point might still stand. I think he's an absolute phenomenon. Mm. I think he's incredible.
There's very few players have ever had that sort of blend of power and skill. I mean, maybe Drogba, but
Emil Heskey
didn't have the pace. I don't think. I don't mean Drogba was.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Would it be stupid to say the original Ronaldo?
No, I think that's totally fair. Yeah,
okay. Costa, he's a player as well. He's got his first red for Chelsea. Now, you mentioned that whole bite business, which there was a lot of hysteria about, to be fair. It was never clear. I don't think it was ever particularly likely that he'd bitten. I thought he actually deserved some praise for the fact that he's obviously got a temper and he seemed to be able to rein it back in. I thought that after he kind of did the rutting stag thing with Gareth Barry, he actually embraced Barry as if to say thanks for not overreacting to that. That was my reading of. I mean, we're all guessing what was going through Costa's head.
Yeah,
at this point.
I mean, I don't think he did bite him, but there's still something pretty weird about opening your mouth and sticking it on Gareth Barry's neck.
Well, I think if the thought police existed, he definitely thought about a nibble there, didn't he?
Yeah. And credit to him for not doing it. But he's deserved his red card. And
yeah.
And yeah, credit to Barry for not overreacting and for coming out and saying, look, he didn't bite me. So yeah, I guess we move on. The three-match ban.
Which, you know, leaves them with...
Thank God they bought Pato.
Pato.
Yeah. Right.
That's the acid test for that transfer, isn't it?
Do you think, because he isn't due to be back yet.
Pato?
Mm.
I think he was supposedly ready a week or two ago.
He made the trip, but I don't think he was included in the squad for this game.
Did he not get a minute on Saturday at all?
They brought on John Terry up front in the final minute.
Right. So he still hasn't played
played a minute, yeah.
Yeah.
How surprising.
Right. What do they have left to play for, Nick, that he could maybe be of use for?
That's not a great deal.
Nothing
well, left. If they want to keep him for the long term, and I'm absolutely certain that was the plan in bringing him in, they should now play him up top in every single game and learn from it.
Right.
Or maybe pick one of the many brilliant young players they have at the club who, for some reason, never get a game.
Yeah, exactly. Solanke at Vitesse Arnhem.
Well, they've won for the FA Youth Cup 5 of the last 6 years, and none of them ever play. It's just... And this season was the perfect opportunity to give them time, and they haven't. I just don't... I mean, I thought it was a Mourinho thing. He just doesn't trust kids.
Right.
But Hiddink seems to have the same...
The recruitment policy in general at Chelsea's just been dreadful the last few seasons. Falcao as well, at the beginning.
Well, it's very hard not to look at the Pato and Falcao signings and wonder if there might be political reasons for them.
Right. To do with their agents and stuff.
Well, the fact that, I mean, without prejudice, just to give you some facts, the fact that Ramirez moves to China for a hefty fee and his agent is the same as Pato's agent and the same as Miazga's agent.
Right.
Miazga and Pato, who haven't played a second yet.
Right. Well, then people are very excited. And when we mention Miazga, we've got some irate responses that we hadn't really accorded him enough respect.
Well, I mean, when he plays, fair enough, we'll have a look at him. But
right. Okay.
Is that from the ever-stable American audience?
Yes. It's.
I made the mistake of saying something bad about MLS.
Yes.
And, that was unusually vicious.
Was it?
I got the CEO of Portland Timbers calling me a Brit snob.
Well, there you go. We'll be talking about Portland Timbers later on, actually. You know, hipsters that we are. I'm just kidding. You're not just a hipster team. And, of course, I think the thing is, Jonathan, it's a big country. So you get extremes of views there. That's very... but anyway, we'll talk more about America later on. Because I haven't mentioned Reading Palace yet. The Royals' cut run comes to an end. They held on gamely, didn't they, until Balassi went down under that scything challenge.
Of course, Pardew was, you know, very vocal about that afterwards, wasn't he?
He said, I'm not going to give any comment on that at all. Because are you suggesting that Balassi wasn't really tackled that hard, or perhaps at all?
Well, there was a slight touch, as there was against Benteke last week. And maybe it was a soft penalty.
Yeah, well, Pardew catching some flack for that himself, for speaking out on one, not on the other. But if you're a football manager, what are you going to do?
Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, so they go through Palace 2-0. And the draw will be on next Tuesday, I think. Next Tuesday they're going to do the draw. No, it's tonight.
The one show.
on the One Show tonight. Mm. Sorry, it's tonight on the One Show.
It's quite a nice sort of old school looking semi final lineup, isn't it? Mm. Like it's, it almost sort of mirrors as well the sort of general craziness of the Premier League this year. I mean, maybe United will win their replay at West Ham, but it's sort of reminds you of something out of the late 80s or early 90s or something. Palace, Watford, you know.
Sounds good to me.
Last time Watford beat Arsenal was the quarterfinal in 87.
Was it then?
And they then lost to Spurs in the semi final. When can you remember who their goalkeeper was, Watford, for that game?
Alec Chamberlain.
Tony Cotton was injured. Steve Sherwood was injured. So for one game only, they played Gary Plumley, who was a waiter in a wine bar and was a club secretary's son. He'd played in Hong Kong. So, you know, he wasn't a complete chancy. He was a semi-pro, maybe, I don't know, even low ranks of a pro game keeper. Played one game for them. I don't think he was at fault at all for the 4-1 defeat. And with the money that Watford gave him, one paycheck, he bought a fridge, which he called the Watford Fridge.
Brilliant.
Then he moved to Newport and became an estate agent.
Mm. Wow. Mm. That's an astonishingly full biography of...
It's almost like I looked him up yesterday.
Well, yeah.
Wow. He called his fridge for Watford Fridge.
The Watford Fridge, because he bought it with the Watford money, yeah. Wow.
That's amazing.
I'm trying to make a joke about him having come in from the cold, but it's not not quite happening, is it?
No, I'm thinking. Everyone take a second on this. Listeners, you got anything? No? All right, then.
So if anybody knows if Gary Plumley's still being an estate agent in Newport...
Gary,
that would be quite
there?
That would be a good interview to do.
Has he still got the fridge? Yeah.
Is it still working? Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. It's probably one of those old ones, like CFC's coming out the back and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. CFC's coming out the back of the FA Cup quarterfinals this week, but not Man United, thanks to Martial's late equaliser. And how about that Payet free kick?
Fantastic.
He was sort of wheeling away after hitting it, wasn't it?
That's great, isn't it?
One of those where he's... I mean, it did hit the post and going, actually, but he sort of knew it was in the moment he left his foot. There's a great angle where you see him hitting and it's just peeling off and, you know, don't blame him. It was a fantastic hit.
It was... Yeah, producer Ben just pointed out, because we had this chat about people walking away from goals before they're in and you know, parallels, we say, Hollywood actors walking away from explosions. And it was Payet who did it a couple of weeks ago, we think.
Well, there's a quote last week from Rudy Garcia talking about Payet's free kick taking. He made him sound like he's kind of the Johnny Wilkinson of the free kick, in that he just stayed for hours practicing and perfecting the free kicks. Although I saw yesterday a West Ham fan tweet before the game that Payet took about 10 practice free kicks before the match and not one of them went in.
Right.
Which leads me to believe that nobody should put a wall in front of Payet when he takes a free kick, because he must use the wall. Every player uses the wall
as a guide.
Yeah, as a guide. That's how you calibrate your free kick. And I saw he waited and waited and waited until, I can't remember who it was, maybe it was Winston Reid, ran up from the defence to bolt himself onto the end of the wall before he took his run up and hit the free kick. But if you're as far out as he was yesterday, I just think you just take the wall out of that. He doesn't take a free kick like Gareth Bale and Ronaldo. It's not a knuckleball style one where you can't predict where it's going to end up in the back of the goal. You know that he's going to aim for a corner of the goal. If you have a really good view from 25 yards plus, I think it was about 25 yards yesterday, you're going to save that if you don't put anyone in the wall. So that's what team should do against him now.
Fascinating, Greg. Yeah, it's a very good shout. Well, anyway, so it did go in. There was a wall, and then Man United looked done and dusted. Looked like another abject defeat for Louis van Gaal until Anthony Martial grabbed the equaliser. Was that a fair? I must admit, I was busy preparing something else while this game was going on, so I didn't get to see how much that mirrored the, you know,
I thought they showed a bit more fight after
United.
Yeah, than in other games. I don't think the quality was incredible, but. There was, you know, Herrera, who had quite a poor game, you know, threw himself into a tackle, won the ball back, got the crowd up a bit, and, you know, they managed to get themselves back in the game just on effort alone, it seems. Mm-hmm. And Martial mirrored that in that he won the ball, got it out wide, and busted gut to get back into the box to get on the end of it. And also benefited massively from Schweinsteiger using his... Shall we say his huge hips to bundle Adrian into the back of the goal so Martial could finish into an empty net.
Although Man United was suggesting that Schweinsteiger himself was off balance because he'd been pushed by one of the West Ham defenders.
He's been off balance a lot this season, hasn't he?
Yeah, fair enough. Anyway, that means they're going to have a replay at Upton Park. Nobody knows when, sometime in April probably. That'll be the last FA Cup game ever at Upton Park. Wow, what an occasion that's going to be, eh?
Exactly, and I think it was the Liverpool game, wasn't it, in the last round that, you know, had quite a rousing finish, and everyone thought, well, what a great way to send off the old stadium in the Cup. And now they've got to do it all again, and it'll be a hell of an atmosphere.
It certainly will. Speaking of Liverpool, of course, they're next up for Man United this Thursday, 2-0 up from the leg, from the first leg at Anfield. Greg?
I think Liverpool will go through. I think when the draw was first made, you often think that the team who gets the second leg has the advantage, but it seems to have worked very much in Liverpool's favour in that it's given United a massive dilemma. The 2-0 scoreline has put them in a difficult position because the fans will want United to go for it, and if they do, I think Liverpool are really well equipped to get them on the counter and score and leave and basically kill the tie off. So they don't want to see a Van Gaal team probably, you know, dominate possession as they do and look very sterile, although that could be the best way for them to go through against Liverpool, in that if they nick one goal and they're in control of the game, there's a possibility they could force extra time and then they can really go for it. So I'd be very intrigued to see how Van Gaal sets up in that time.
It's only been twice before that United have been 2-0 down in a two-legged knockout European tie, and both times they've come back to win it.
Really?
Against Barcelona in 1984, the famous game, and then against Olympiacos 2 years ago.
Wow. David Moyes in charge.
Yeah, is that true? Have I just made that up?
No, I think you're right.
Was that the one where Joel Campbell scored in the first leg?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But the Barcelona game, I actually watched the Barcelona game the other day on YouTube. It's, and the atmosphere looks absolutely amazing that night. Frank Stapleton says it's the best atmosphere he's ever played in front of.
Really?
He scored the third goal in that game. It was like 2 minutes after the second goal, kind of, I don't know, 8-10 minutes in the second half. And there's a... Robson plays his brilliant ball out to the left. Arthur Olberson puts it across to the back post. And I think it must be Whiteside wins it and knocks it down. Everybody's gone to that post. And Stapleton's just in loads and loads of space. And all he's got to do is sort his feet out and absolutely lashes it in. You've never seen a man finish a ball with such relish.
Well, fabulous. Well, we'll see what happens in that Europa League tie. Not the only Europa League tie that's coming up, of course, Thursday night. But that's more than enough for part one, I would say. So how's about we return in a moment or two with a spot of Spurs Borussia Dortmund and our favourite German. Raphael Honigstein's on the line, everybody. Hi, Rafa.
Hello, James.
Hi there. And hello, Jonathan and Greg and Nick as well, Rafa. They're all here, eager to hear what thoughts you have on the subject of Dortmund's trip to Spurs on Thursday, and maybe a little bit of Bayern against Juventus as well. Let's start with Thomas Tuchel's Borussia Dortmund anyway. 3-0, any question about how this tie is going to go in the second leg?
I don't think so. It seems to me that Spurs don't want an upset. They don't even want to try to knock Dortmund out. I must say, along with most German observers, I was a little bit perplexed that they came all the way, literally, to Germany, but of course also in the sense of going through the competition, only then to effectively raise the white flag and roll over. I think it was a real shame. I think we were robbed of one of the great games, potentially, of the European fixture list this season. Dortmund were still outstanding and were applauded off the pitch by both sets of fans, but you would have loved to see them actually take on a full-strength Spurs team.
Yeah, a lot of commentators in the UK asking about where Dortmund would hypothetically finish in the Premier League. James Grok positing that question as well. What's your impression if you wanted to play that game?
I certainly think they would be title contenders. Well, what is hard to, of course, compare across the leagues is that Dortmund are constructed for the Bundesliga. You know, they play a certain style that works in the league. Their progression from being a very pressing and almost a counter-attacking team to a more possession team is really in reaction to what's happened to Germany, where everybody now more or less plays that way. Under Thomas Tuchel, they've developed into a different side. And of course, you know, they make use of all the things that Bundesliga teams can use in their advantage: the winter break, fewer games, more rotation, etc. So, very hard sort of to, even as a thought, idea, construct, put to plunge them into the Premier League and find out what would happen. But I think in terms of what they can actually do, on a day, I'm convinced that they could take on any Premier League team, home and away, and come out on top in a tie.
All right, okay. Well, what we should do is get like all the big clubs together for a European Super League, and then we wouldn't have to hypothesise about this. Okay, well, Borussia Dortmund, I believe I'm right in saying the highest scorers in Europe. Is that right, Raf? 106 goals?
I think you're right, yeah. Even though I'm not sure that Messi might have not scored by himself more than that.
Right. Or PSG in one game against Troyes, perhaps. Who knows? We'll talk about them a bit later on. But on Wednesday, meanwhile, massive game, and this one really does seem still very delicately poised. Bayern Munich hosting Juventus at the Allianz Arena. They were all over the old lady in the first leg, but still, that shift in momentum that led to it being tied up by the Turin Giants 2-2. Wow, how worried has that got the Bavarians?
Well, I think they were slightly more worried going into this game than coming out of it. But still, I think there was a sense of frustration and of an opportunity being having been missed, because they could have probably killed off the tie, effectively threw away the win, and now encouraged Juventus to perhaps be slightly more proactive. And,
right.
Because Juve, like in Munich,
Juve seemed to pay a little bit too much respect to Bayern for the first hour or so. Just a couple of things. First of all, I don't think Juve fans can expect them to be that bad again. And secondly, defensively, is Bayern still going with that same kind of back four or back three of where you're the centre-back pairing of Kimmich and Alaba?
Well, maybe Benatia might be in a position where he can actually start from the outset. He played at the weekend. Bayern kept a clean sheet. They've been very, very solid since that Juventus game, with the exception, of course, of losing at home to Mainz, which is a bit of a freak result. But they've looked better in recent weeks. And Guardiola will have to make a decision. He loves Kimmich. He loves Alaba. In Benatia, he's got somebody who's a little bit slower and not as good on the ball, but, of course, a better player when it comes to defending against set pieces and the physical threat that Juventus, especially with Mandzukic, pose. So we'll have to see. Maybe a back three is an option as well, with all these three players in there.
Okay.
But I think that Bayern are aware that, in a way that, you know, if they play their game as well as they did through the first 60 minutes or so, they can make Juventus look quite ordinary. But what they mustn't do, of course, is being caught a little bit in two minds, which can happen in the second leg when you go into it effectively being ahead, which they are after the 2-2 draw. And, you know, we've seen Arsenal come there and cause them real problems. We've seen other games where they just haven't been on their game so much when they not really feel under pressure in the game itself. And I think Juventus will try that game again, where they sort of lull them into a sort of false sense of security and then maybe punish them. It's a very Italian way, something we in Germany see that way, of winning. And Bayern have historically really struggled when they come up against sides like that. So I think it's going to be a fascinating tie, very tense, very nervous, unless Bayern, of course, take one of their first few opportunities and put some numbers on the board early on.
Right. Rafa, thank you so much for joining us and pretending to be worried about this game.
My pleasure.
Raphael Honigstein, everybody. What do you think, Jonathan? Is it cut and dried, this one?
For Bayern?
Yes.
I mean, I think they're pretty strong favourites, but no, that's not cut and dried.
Mm. Which Champions League game are you most looking forward to?
Oh, that one, this week. Yeah. No question.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only two of the games really still alive.
Yeah, well, Man City, I mean,
they'd have to... Even City, surely.
Even
can't
City,
up.
Surely.
They'll still go through.
Yeah.
It's just a pity that Kiev have such a long winter break.
Does it to Russian-Ukrainian teams all the time.
Yeah, 9th of December to the 24th of February, their break was. Then they play City. They've since had two league games and won both of those, so they'll probably be, you know, a little more back in form for this game, but it's too late, so it's
and
such
I think
a shame.
It explains why Russian-Ukrainian teams have quite a good record in the Europa League.
Mm.
Because you don't have to be that good to get through the last 32 of the Europa League. So you know,
come on.
The effects of that three-month break aren't as significant. And then, of course, they're much fresher by the time you get to the quarterfinals. But they never get to the quarterfinals of the Champions League because they're always losing the last 16.
Right. Also this week, of course, you've got Atletico Madrid against PSV. It was 0-0, I think, the first leg, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that should be intriguing. But I saw
probably,
bits of the first leg of that, and I was quickly turning back to the...
Atletico don't concede goals, do they? So I guess, yeah.
PSV hosting Ajax in a probable title decider this weekend as well. They've got a big week ahead of them. They are 1 point behind Eindhoven with seven games to go. So that'll be exciting in the Eredivisie. Well, that's your Champions League lineup. In terms of Europa League, and here I've got to look for a piece of paper because I know that you've got the holders who are looking for the three-peat Sevilla. They're hosting Basel. It was 0-0 in the first leg. You've got Lazio, who might well end up as the last Italian side in Europe. They're, I think, 1-1 from their leg away against Sparta Prague.
So that's vital in terms of the coefficient.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. As bad as English clubs have done, they're being really helped out coefficient-wise by the Italian sides.
Well, the Italian sides had a pretty rough draw generally, didn't they?
They did.
That's really helped the English teams. Mm. And also, the two English teams being drawn against each other guarantees half a point from that game.
Bingo. Oh, I've just found the piece of paper. Right, OK. Yeah, Valencia, Athletic Bilbao. Bilbao, a goal up. Valencia, another poor result for Gary Neville this weekend. Did you see?
He was scathing about it, wasn't he?
What did he say, Nick?
I can't remember.
He said something like, the basic premise of football is that you outrun, or you run as hard, you tackle as hard, you basically are as committed as the other team, and that we didn't see that from my players today. That's dangerous when you chew out your players, you know, on live TV like that.
And I think the striker, Paco Alcacer, said the same thing afterwards. He said, we were just on the pitch. We weren't. So if he's saying that, I don't know if he's digging someone else out or admitting that his attitude wasn't there either.
Mm.
But it was a game that on paper, I think they were away, weren't they? But they should have got something from. And it's a bit of a concern if after the recent resurgence they had, he can't get enough out of them.
Oddly, the only other manager who's been scathing about his players this weekend or just before the weekend was Aitor Karanka, who has been linked with the Valencia job.
Really?
Yeah. Well, he was, yeah, before. I don't know if that's got anything to do with it, but if a manager who has upset his players so much ended up coming into Valencia.
Right.
It sounds like they upset him as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also out there in Europa League last 16 land, you've got your Anderlecht against Shakhtar Donetsk. Shakhtar, a mighty 3-1 lead from the first leg. Sporting Braga, can they turn it around against Fenerbahce? I don't know, but we'll find out. Oh, I haven't mentioned Bayer Leverkusen against Villarreal either. Villarreal, in their brightly coloured tops, and make an unlikely choice as dark horses, but they are pretty special, this Villarreal side. Anyway, should also mention, we were just talking about Valencia losing this weekend. Goal scored by they were beaten by Levante with a goal scored by Pepito Rossi. Rossi back, a great goal. I'm moving on now because in terms of big European stories, they don't come any bigger than Paris Saint-Germain. They're already French champions. It's not even mid-March. They are French champions. It's a record, Jonathan.
Hello.
Yeah. Do you know, nobody's ever clinched the title this early in the top five leagues. They've got eight games to go.
Tremendous.
In other leagues, so it has been Olympiacos, for example, already, some would say, possibly before the season even began. But I wouldn't say that without. Yeah. But anyway, and it's hard not to feel your heart warmed by the tremendous story of Paris Saint-Germain's season. After Monaco went and fluffed their lines yet again this weekend, all they needed to do was win against the tremendously struggling Troyes. So they went there and they beat them 9-0. Here's my stat of the week. In that game, Paris Saint-Germain scored more goals at Troyes than Troyes have scored goals at Troyes all season. That's brilliant. Yeah. Anyway. Right. In other news, Scottish League Cup win for Ross County. That's their first ever silverware. Alex Schalk with a 90th-minute winner over Hibs.
Which places both of the Scottish Cups in the Highlands for the first time in history, with Inverness, Caledonia, Thistle currently being Scottish Cup holders as well.
Right. Okay. Here's a post you'll enjoy. Uvert Form says, will the pod ever drop the lazy and slightly mean-spirited hipster's favourite tag while mentioning Portland Timbers? We're not lazy or spite. Well, yeah, we're lazy. That's it. Yeah.
And he, I don't know. Will their owner stop abusing me on Twitter?
Well, I guess when you stop being a Brit snob, Jonathan. Uvert Form, I won't read through it because it's a long paragraph here about why they've got plenty of history behind them, Portland Timbers, and he says, if someone could tell me where all these phantom spinach salads and barbecued tofu sandwiches could be had, I'd love to know, as I'm sick of the overpriced greasy hot dogs on match day. So look, they have proper food.
So what they're saying is the owner's not looking after the fans. Rise up, Portland Timbers fans.
Yep.
Overthrow this Merritt Paulson buffoon.
Is that what his name?
Something like that.
All right, okay. You're clearly not a fan. But anyway, Portland Timbers, reigning MLS champions. But it's funny we should mention them because fantastic. Oh, they got beaten by the San Jose, the controversially named San Jose Earthquakes. I just find that strange that if you live on, you know, in an area which has been severely afflicted by the San Andreas Fault, you would celebrate that with your choice of team nickname. Anyway, they beat the reigning MLS champs 2-1. Or should it just be reigning MLS champs? Because anyway, 2-1 with an amazing goal from Quincy Amariqua. Have you seen this one? Kevin Garrity says, can we have a description of it? Have you seen it? It's a great goal. Basically, this fellow Quincy Amariqua, I'm not familiar with him. He's 28 years old, apparently. He's running along. And do you know what? It's a little bit like, but a bit less spectacular than the Florenzi goal against Barcelona earlier in the group stages of the Champions League. He's basically running along. He's almost out by the touchline. It's not as far out. He's maybe 30 yards out. And he just unleashes this phenomenal chip, but it's too far out to be a chip. But anyway, yeah. And in it goes.
Was it hit really hard?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, was it you yesterday, Jonathan, was saying, where has the...
Yeah.
Well, but it wasn't one of those rising shots. Oh, okay. It wasn't a surface-to-air missile. It was a looping. I mean, I would call it a chip, but it feels too far out.
Why did they stop doing the measurement of the speed of shots?
Having looked at the knowledge, it just shows how utterly ludicrous those speed guns were, because it turns out David Hurst has hit a ball about 20% harder than any other man in history.
Really?
All the harder shots in history happened between 1996 and 1998.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because Gigi Riva, El Rombo di Tuono, which has got to be one of the greatest nicknames for a footballer ever, the Rumble of Thunder, that is. He was the man who, in one of the most unlikely title-winning stories ever, I mean, even more so probably than Leicester, made Cagliari champions of Italy in an era when, you know, overturning the odds was not an easy thing in Italy, you know, to put it bluntly. Anyway, he famously broke a child's arm with his shot. A child who was innocently watching a game from behind the goal, and thwack, have a broken arm, laddie.
I had this discussion with former Sunderland goalkeeper David Priest on Twitter yesterday. Yep. He had his wrist broken in a warm-up. Not when he was playing for Sunderland, I don't think. But in 1935... the great River centre forward Bernabe Ferreira, who is famous for his ferocious shot, they said that it was because of fans going to watch him they were able to afford to pay for El Monumental. But he'd never missed a penalty, and all the papers were sort of in those days were as a publicity thing, would compete to offer prizes to goalkeepers he's coming up against. If you kept a clean sheet, you got a clock or something. And if you're the first one to save a penalty from him, then you got some nice prize. And there was an Independiente goalkeeper saved a penalty from him and broke both his wrists.
Ooh, but he kept it out.
But kept it out, yeah. Wow. But I couldn't work out. They played twice that season. River won one of the games 4-3. The other one was 1-1. I don't know which game it was in.
Right.
And all of this is in my book on Argentinian football, which will be out in August, Angels with Dirty Faces.
Oh, great. What's it called? Angels with Dirty Faces?
Yeah, you can pre-order it.
Right. Anyway, also, before I take a little pause, I'm going to say ID 608-7845, who we'll hear from very shortly, says, can we also mention Alex Morgan's goal against Germany for the USA last night? He puts woof at the end, which is a fair description, but I mean, other people have compared it to Gazza's against Scotland. It's one of those, you know, loop it over the defender, then lash it in. Very nice. And they won, USA, the She Believes Cup as a result of that goal, I believe. And that's got to be the greatest name for a cup, isn't it? The She Believes Cup.
Well done, then. Did you see Lukaku said that his goal against Chelsea was not the greatest he'd scored in his career, but his greatest was in a friendly against Luxembourg?
No, I hadn't seen that.
That was doing the rounds on Twitter earlier.
Yeah, is that one of those missing goals? Does it actually...
No, the footage exists. Okay. It's actually... I don't think it's as good a goal. He sort of beats two people, and it's a sort of smoother goal.
Right.
And the finish is much more sort of placed rather than driven. But I don't think it's anywhere near as good a goal.
Maybe it's just the visceral high he got from it against Luxembourg.
It must really
Belgium-Luxembourg, that's a
Exactly.
He's just trying to appeal to the hipsters, possibly the Portland Timbers hipsters, yeah, by being contrary.
Hey, I tell you what, we've got this far into a show, listeners, and possibly you have too, and we still haven't mentioned all the Premier League activity that happened over the weekend and the massive game that's coming up Monday night. We'll redress that little error right after this.
Hello, and welcome to another day of Export Opportunity. UK education is respected globally, and the world wants to learn from us. If you provide educational services, training or technology, there are many opportunities for you. To find yours, visit exportingisgreat.gov.uk.
Right, Premier League. Spurs won. Poor Aston Villa couldn't keep a clean sheet, but they did keep several ones with learner out written on them. Fans kept putting them out. Stewards kept taking them down. But anyway, Spurs with that win, 2 for Harry Kane. They moved 2 points off Leicester. Leicester go at it Monday night. Now, I'm hoping producer Ben is especially alacritous with sticking today's pod out and that you get to hear this chat before that game takes place with this inevitable 3-0 win for Leicester against Rafa Benitez's new Newcastle. But that's obviously the big story, isn't it? You've got the table toppers. Can they go back to 5 points clear? They're taking on a Newcastle team now guided by the expert hand of Rafa Benitez. Nick, you're going to be there. What are you going to see?
I think it's very hard to say. I mean, suddenly there's a lot more possibilities for the game. I think Benitez...
What possibilities? Well, it's still Newcastle.
It is still Newcastle, and I think it's been well ascertained that they are virtually unmanageable by whoever's in charge. But Rafa, from what he's said so far, sounded confident that he had them in training, I think, on Saturday and had been trying a few tweaks and
He came in, what day was he in? It was on Friday, wasn't it? And he called them in from their day off.
On Saturday, and Coloccini was like watching him doing the attacking drills and stuff like that.
All right.
It's the exact opposite of Joe Kinnear's approach of... arriving, have a day off, lads.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not saying one's more valid than the other, but we'll see, I guess, this evening. Do you see anything in that squad that could be moulded into a side that could climb out of
Newcastle's squad?
Trouble?
Yeah, definitely.
Even with the problems at the back?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got some really good players.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem is just the fact that the club's almost been set up to be a sort of, you know, a clearinghouse for players wanting to move from Europe into the Premier League. That what happens is if they start a game well, they play well. But as soon as anything goes against them, they don't really care. You know, they don't feel Newcastle. They don't feel the club in any sense.
Right.
That's why they're so prone to meltdown.
How as a Sunderland supporter?
Yeah, we're doomed. Rafa will keep them up. It's awful news.
Really?
Yeah. They've done the thing that we do. Right. Our clever tactic of bringing in a manager 2 games before the derby to win the derby.
Yeah.
Which we've done with our last. 4 managers?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Allardyce,
you've certainly won 6 in a row.
Allardyce, Advocaat.
Di Canio.
And Poyet, but yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, those 4.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, they're basically... They're copying our tactic. Well done, them. Congratulations.
Rafa's got this knack of just being able to prepare the team brilliant. You know, for these, like, the European games midweek, these one-off big occasions, and I think he'll just be treating every game he has at Newcastle like that now, where he will go forensic on his detail about the opponents and how he's going to set the team up, and he will probably do enough to frustrate opponents and give Newcastle the opportunity to nick games and the points he needs to stay up. And I think, yeah, if I was a Sunderland fan, I would be worried.
I think what we've got to do now is sort of... I mean, sorry, just to sort of amplify your point, the fact that they have no other distractions, he's got a week between games, he's got time to do that, which I think was occasionally the problem in the past, that he had a Champions League game, maybe didn't prepare for the weekend as well. But I think Sunderland now have to look at Crystal Palace and think, try and catch them.
Wow. 9 points, is it? Is it 9?
8, I think.
Eight points. Right.
But Palace have only picked up 2 points from the last 10 league games. I know they've won 4 in the FA Cup in that time.
Mm.
Maybe the FA Cup's a distraction. And it is a feature of Pardew sides. I was looking at this this morning, actually. What's happened to every team where he's left on bad terms? So not what happened at Reading. And then the Southampton thing was a bit weird that he left early in the season when they were still in League 2. But the other 4 clubs he's been at, after roughly 50 games...
Mm.
Suddenly the form dips. It goes from 1.5 points a game to 1 point a game. This is after 37 it's happened.
What, have a guess. Why would that be?
Well, I think there's probably two, maybe three issues. One is there seems to regularly be a dip at the end of the season.
Mm.
And you could almost say Newcastle's dip at the end of the last season, he partially needs to take the responsibility for that.
Right.
If it is something in pre-season that he hasn't prepared them properly, not physically. Right. I mean, yeah, I'm speculating what the reasons might be. I'm not saying this is necessarily the case. But there's a consistent pattern of Pardew teams falling off in the last sort of 10, 15 games of the season. So it may be that. It may be that he's quite an abrasive figure, and maybe, like, as Mourinho winds people up in the third season, with him it happens a bit earlier because they haven't got the silverware to assuage the abrasiveness.
Mm. Anyway.
And then the third thing is that it may be that once teams work out how to play against his sides,
right,
that he's not capable of tactically tweaking it to combat the combating.
Right, okay.
They're my three theories, I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Listen, I'm just going to race on because it's as much, I guess, about Leicester trying to extend their lead again back up to 5 points tonight against Newcastle. We'll see how that goes. Man City jiggers up for them in title terms after that 0-0 with Norwich. They went for it as well. They had two up top, Boney and Aguero. But Norwich, a fantastic point for them, eh? After all the goals they've hemorrhaged. Big thumbs up for you, Norwich fans. We've ticked that box.
Sorry, may not have been enough for them, though.
Do you not think?
I think they probably had to win. But on the other hand, they'd lost something like 8 out of 9 before that, and yet they are still in with a chance.
Well, which, and they've got Sunderland and Newcastle at home in the next sort of 3 or 4 weeks.
Absolutely decisive.
So if they win them, then a couple of other points, and there's something looking good again.
Right, okay.
But I think that's a really alarming thing for Sunderland, is that they should have beaten Palace, you know, 1-0 at half-time against a team that's faltering badly, and they can't finish it off and end up, you know, needing a last-minute goal to nick a point. And then 1-0 up at Southampton, deep into injury time, they concede. And with another 4 points, they could have been thinking about burying Newcastle in the derby rather than just putting daylight.
Right, well, anyway.
Praise
Greg.
For Bournemouth as well.
Yes.
And Eddie Howe, because it's not really been said enough that Bournemouth's first season in the top flight ever, and because of all the, you know, things that other teams have been doing, such as West Ham and Leicester, being forgotten about. He's had loads of injuries there. He's done really well to keep them up, and he's kept them up with 8 games to go. So
Those players, especially the ones who came in, no experience at all.
No, I mean, he brought Tyrone Mings in, his record signing, and he did his cruciate very early on in the season. Other players,
Junior Stanislav, who couldn't even get a game in the Championship, suddenly was.
And you look at where they are now, and that's fantastic. In previous seasons, he'd be getting a lot more praise, I think.
I remember going to their game with Southampton away, I think in November, and they lost 2-0, or they went 2-0 in the first half, gave it a bit of a go in the second half, but never looked like getting back into it. And I was looking back at what I wrote, and I said it's going to be a long winter for them, just because they're down to the barest of bare bones, and they really have been. I think signing a Phobie in January was quite important, because he's done a bit of what Callum Wilson would have done for them, perhaps giving them that pace and power up front and stuff. But I think Greg's right. What Howe's done is remarkable.
They've stayed up with style as well. They've done it with a panache. That game at the weekend, 3-2. They've had exciting games throughout the season. Really good one against Everton as well. And just really nice to watch, and quite a breath of fresh air.
And Southampton, meanwhile, in another South Coast success story, beat Stoke at the Britannia. Lovely. 2 goals for Graziano Pelle.
Graziano Pelle, who had been on a bit of a goal drought, I think.
Yeah, and especially away from home. He doesn't score away from home, so they say. He does now. Let's finish off. You mentioned Aitor Karanka at Borough, or no longer at Borough. And let's just finish off with a quick roundup, listeners. If you haven't been keeping track of what's been going on in the Championship, well, Burnley are running away with it. They're 7 points clear now after a 3-1 win at Huddersfield. The big story, though, Borough, they're second with the game in hand. Karanka walking out on Friday night. He'd had a furious row with his senior players, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they'd lost to Rotherham last week in midweek, 1-0 later, and actually missed a load of chances in the first half. But but Karanka had accused them of not all fighting to the last ball and stuff like that, and I think they lost right at the end of the game.
Right, they went and lost, and after he left on Sunday, they lost as well.
Yeah, exactly, against Charlton. And I think it's an interesting thing that's happening in the Championship now. It's interesting that of the teams that maybe didn't have any parachute payments, Borough and Derby, right, both spent, you know, tens, twenties, actually, of millions. We've seen what's happened at Derby already with Paul Clement, and maybe with the owner Mel Morris going down into the dressing room and not being a very happy camp. And the same kind of thing at Borough. You think the pressure is so intense now. The stakes are so high when you've spent that much money and you're not getting what you think you should out of your players. I also think Karanka all season has been saying after games, we've got a team that has got more quality than anyone else. We should be winning these games. And that kind of pressure can work in many different ways, I think.
From a nominative determinism point of view, it's really interesting to see somebody called Cranker, you know, just basically losing his rag, and a team called Borough digging themselves into a hole. Anyway, you mentioned Derby. They also had problems with Rotherham. That was this Saturday. They threw away a 3-goal lead. Rotherham scoring 3 goals in 7 minutes, apparently, on Saturday to earn that draw. Yes, with the now fifth-place Derby. And, hey, what's all this about? Derby against Forest next Saturday. Daniel Storey pointing out that it's going to be an ex-Forest defender, caretaker manager of Derby, against an ex-Derby defender who's a caretaker manager of Forest. Can you explain this to me?
No.
Ah. All right. Well, basically, so Doogie Freedman's been let go, in a very real sense, by Nottingham Forest. But I'm not sure. He's a freed man, says producer Ben. And I'm not sure who's come in for him, but it was somebody who used to be at Derby. Oh, dear listeners. Backing up even further, Charlton talked about the fact that they beat Borough 2-0 on Sunday. This was after and despite, or perhaps because of, who knows, all the Charlton protests. Matt White, Luis Mendes both posting in saying, what did you make of the funeral, the beach ball, the whistle protest? Did you see all this, Nick?
I saw clips of it. They were marching outside the stadium before in a very funereal way, holding up a coffin and a banner, wishing rid of Roland Duchatelet, the owner, and Catherine Myra, the CEO. And then I've not seen everything that happened, but I believe the start of the game got at least interrupted by checking beach balls on the pitch.
Yeah, loads of beach balls.
A lot of beach balls.
I'm sure they blew whistles, which disrupted play as well, which I'm surprised doesn't happen more often.
It's a very effective way, isn't it?
Happens, I
seem to just be talking about things that happened in the FA Cup in 1990, but Hereford versus Manchester United in the fourth round.
Oh yeah.
Hereford had a very, very good chance. Jim Leighton made quite a good save because the United defence stopped because somebody blew a whistle in the crowd.
Right.
And United went on to win 1-0 with a late goal from Clayton Blackmore.
In a lot of Latin countries, ill-thinking fans, you'll often see them shining those laser pens at goalies, say during a penalty or something like that. Why they won't go for the cheaper alternative of a whistle, which would be vastly, from what you're saying, more effective in terms of disrupting scoring opportunities. That's something for them to consider in future.
Or something I saw a Sunderland crowd do once, and obviously I don't condone this, but it was hilarious at the time. The ball went into the crowd. Sunderland were clinging on to a 1-0 lead, I think. And yeah, they held the ball, so okay, chuck another ball on. Then as whoever, I can't remember who Sunderland were playing, but whoever was, the other team was breaking down the left, just chucked the ball on. Actually hit the ball.
Brilliant.
So tackled him with the ball thrown from the crowd.
Right.
Obviously disgraceful, and I can't condone that, but.
Okay. And of course, you got the beach ball at Sunderland in
Well,
Liverpool.
That was Liverpool fans' fault, though. It was Liverpool fans who brought the beach ball. They reaped what they sowed.
Yeah, absolutely. And perhaps it's a lesson for all of us in that. One last thing on that championship thing, if you're still there. Doogie Freedman's former club, Bolton, lost 2-1 at home to Preston. They're now 6 points adrift with 9 games to go. Looks like they'll be waving goodbye to the championship.
Yeah, they've. I think their takeover went through. Did it last week with the Dean Holdsworth consortium.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sure of the exact details, and obviously you worry a bit.
Do you get parachute payments out of the championship?
No. Don't think so.
Well, you say 6 points adrift, 6 points to Charlton, but 11 points to safety. So it's worse than 6 points.
It's not a good situation.
And also Charlton winning and Rotherham with new lease life under Neil Warnock.
They've now got, Rotherham have got 7 points from the last 3 games and under Neil Warnock, who I think said a couple of weeks ago, the championship is exactly what I'm cut out for, and I guess we take that in a positive way.
Right. He's done wonders out. Yeah, I was talking about Rotherham, but of course Neil Warnock's the tactical genius behind all of that. Brilliant.
Yeah, got them very, very hard working. I think Leon Best is banging the goals in for them now.
Nice. Neil Warnock, a big fan of championship football and show tunes as well. Great. Anyway, that's it. And walks in Richmond Park. You'll often see him there having a stroll in Richmond Park.
He's a very, very competitive man, Neil Warnock. I once beat him in a sports quiz. And he absolutely, yeah, it was the Independent Christmas Lunch always has a quiz.
Oh, yeah.
And he was on a different team to me.
Hmm.
And
that was his first mistake.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I think we won it by a point or maybe 2 points.
Can you remember the question?
The key question, that he accused me of cheating over was which sport caused the most injuries per person doing it in the US in, I don't know, 2009 or whatever year it was.
Right.
And I happened to have read something that morning about it. And it, do you know what it is?
I mean, it's going to be some surprising, like
tennis
or something.
Yeah, you probably don't even think of it as a sport.
Is it rodeo?
Or maybe it was which sporting activity. Maybe that's how it was phrased.
Golf?
Not rodeo, not golf.
Swimming?
Billiards?
Cheerleading.
Really?
Really?
Cheerleading. Yeah. And you got that.
I got that because it's a complete chance I'd read something about it.
Is that
and
what
he was
right
in my face, wagging his finger, kind of accusing me of it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not like Neil Warnock.
How do they injure each other? Do they cuff each other around the face with their pom-poms? Or?
I think it's like muscle strain.
No, I mean,
they drop
to be
each
fair,
other
Nick, I don't think you're being a bit Brit snob about this. It's a little bit like kind of rhythmic gymnastics. I think there's some pretty full-on kind of, there's aerial stuff, there's pyramids, all that.
I'm guessing a lot of them aren't as good at gymnastics as they ought to be to do some of the things that they do. Because
I don't know.
Well, no, just the person who's, you know, they lift someone up to the top, and
they're doing backflips, all sorts of crazy stuff. Just out of interest, when it became apparent that you got the answer right and he hadn't, did he try and injure several other members of his team so that the conference couldn't go on?
I didn't see that, but I wouldn't say it definitely didn't happen.
Right. Well, on that fascinating anecdote, that's where we come to the end of today's Football Weekly. Many thanks to Nick, to Jonathan, and to Greg. And to you, listener, and producer Ben, Thursday we'll be back reacting to all the latest football news and previewing what looks like being another big weekend. So do join us then. Have yourselves a great week in the meanwhile.